are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 17th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, UCLA professor Ramesh Srinivasan. His book, Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Tech of Tomorrow. Also on the program today, impeachment marches across the country. Literally, there are impeachment marches across the country today. Hopefully you're listening to this while you're at one. And frontline centrist Dems begin to line up behind said impeachment. Meanwhile, purple state Republican senators start to freak out about a trial in the Senate. As Mitch McConnell says, we won't call any witnesses because that's the only fair thing to do. Donald Trump's Saudi arms deal, this is the emergency one with no congressional approval, allows the Saudis to host production of smart bombs. What could go wrong? Judge allows Georgia to purge more than 300,000 voters overnight. It's added to the over 200,000 in Wisconsin the other day. And the DCCC, fresh off their massive failure in supporting a guy who turned into a Republican, blacklists firms working with any Democratic primary challengers, but okays working with the Republicans. The Mormon Church accused of hoarding cash ostensibly collected for charity. Speaking of charity, the Sackler family has been sucking Purdue Pharma of billions leading up to its bankruptcy. And 90 of the Fortune 500 paid no federal income tax in 2018. Starting to see a theme here, folks. Trump Treasury regulators may twist the Community Reinvestment Act so it can be used for millionaire and billionaire sports teams owners to build stadiums as long as it's in areas of poverty. All this and more on today's Majority Report.
It's how you fight it.
Through the looking glass, we're going to take your property, kick you out, give the money to millionaires and billionaires, and you're welcome.
And then you could be collecting rags for yourself. And then you look out and you go, that stadium, we built that.
Yeah. I mean, you'll look out from a distance. Just a little bit of house cleaning. We've gotten a lot of emails asking, will the AM quickie happen over your Christmas break? And the answer is more than likely. We are working on figuring that out. I desperately want to be able to sleep in, but at the same time, maybe I can just go back to sleep and take a nap after that. But subscribe by going to amquickie.com. 5 minutes every morning. More or less a little bit extended headlines. And of course, from a left perspective. But a quick way to catch up on what the day's news is, particularly when we're gone. Yesterday? We had talked about a New York Times article that had come out about Cenk Uygur and about Bernie Sanders' retracting his endorsement. We discussed in the fun half some of the things that, you know, we found problematic with the things that Cenk has said in the past. The vast, you know, he's apologized for those things. We had different discussions about that. But the gist of what we were talking about in terms of the New York Times, which is, I think, indicative of a major problem at the Times, was that they had presumably, I don't know, there was a Twitter account that has really gone ballistic. I mean, in a way that I've very rarely seen such vigorous research done by an amateur Twitterer. It's almost impressive in terms of the relentlessness and also the disingenuousness. They cut a clip of Cenk Uygur with David Duke, where David Duke was saying, "I'm not racist." And Cenk said, "Right, you're not racist." And the New York Times reported that as Cenk Uygur agrees that David Duke is not racist. When in fact, with any context, and maybe just even watching that video without it being in context, it's quite clear that Uygur is being what is known as sarcastic. Sarcasm is this very, very nuanced new form of communication that the New York Times may not be aware of. Anyways, they were informed that there is this new methodology of registering disdain called sarcasm or facetiousness. And they added a correction to the piece that, of course, nobody goes back and reads, right? I mean, back in the day, if you issued a correction, the way that people read newspapers was like, I read Monday's paper and then I read Tuesday's. And on Tuesday, I see, oh, there's a correction. But what they do is they just attach it to Monday's paper as if people go back and, you know what? I read that thing about Uygur yesterday. I think I'm going to read it again just to see if there's a correction.
Yeah, I bookmark my articles right, so I can go back.
And this is the correction. An earlier version of this article referred imprecisely to a remark by Cenk Uygur, a radio host who is running for a California congressional seat. When David Duke, the white supremacist, appeared on his show and denied being a racist, Mr. Uygur was replying sarcastically when he said, "No, of course not." Now, I want to be clear on this. Imprecisely is doing a lot of work there and is a very, very loose term. I mean, it's sort of ironic that imprecisely could be used in such an imprecise way. Because to report this as Cenk Uygur was agreeing with David Duke that he's not a racist, when in fact it turns out that Uygur was sarcastic, in other words, ironic, in other words, saying, "No, of course not," as in, "Of course you are." It is literally precisely 180 degrees from what the reality of that exchange was. And then, of course, like I say, they do this on the piece which nobody goes back to. The only people who will know about this correction are people who are probably already in some way sympathetic or aware of the mistake in the first place, because all those people who just read it casually, they're not going back.
Also, super small point, but I think illustrative. Being a radio show host is totally honorable and great. And if they respected somebody, and if it was somebody else, they would say, like, I don't know, media entrepreneur.
Former MSNBC host.
I mean, it's just such a condescending BS way of describing all of the guy's accomplishments. The disdain and disingenuity still shines through.
I would argue that actually it's not so much about condescending. It is about I think anyone with any type of savvy knows that the people in that district do not, who are going to vote for a Democrat, do not listen to talk radio shows because there are none for them. And that had they said former MSNBC host, right, that would have made a much different impression on people. Yes, absolutely. You could have put entrepreneur. I mean, they own the biggest. Yes, it's just a very odd moniker. He has not been on radio for at least a decade, as far as I remember. Like at one point, they were on Sirius XM, and that's the way the show launched. But he hasn't been on it for, I think about a decade.
The largest progressive radio show or progressive show on the internet.
Right.
But I think, and also I just would like to make a brief, I watched Anna's coverage of this yesterday on the Young Turks, including, by the way, all the other stuff that people dredge up and go over again and again and again, which range from either maybe, you know, like a genuine mistake ages ago that the guys apologized for, or either just like hosting a radio show and having a different sense of humor, which I think people need to get real about, or another smear, like video of Cenk saying, yes, the Armenian genocide happened. I'm sorry I wrote something obnoxious when I was in college and I grew up in a propagandized household. Of course it happened. And people tweet at me this nonsense when I go on there, whenever. It's ridiculous. And I really would watch Anna's segment. It's quite well done.
All right. So that's that. Just wanted to get that out there because, of course, many of you probably don't go back and read the same articles twice.
I think the only time I ever see a correction is if I'm late to read something.
Right. Well, of course.
I'm like, oh, this came out a week ago. I'm glad I caught the correction.
Right. Right. Exactly. The New York Times is telling you that the way you read their paper is you wait 3 or 4 days and then read it.
It's like buying a new gadget.
And it's either malicious or they're hiring some of the dumbest people on earth. I'm sorry. That's my editorial.
It's malicious people.
There is no way that you... if you watched that interview and reported it that way, then you have basic comprehension problems that would rule you out for a high school newspaper.
This is a failure of the editors, too, in a big way. Like, they didn't come across as like, wow, that's weird for a progressive guy, for a guy who's a progressive host to sort of to agree with David Duke. That strikes me as odd. Maybe we should double check that. No, but it probably makes total
sense.
Let's
be real. There's a lot of, you know, insane people out there who identify on the center or however they identify themselves that actually would basically equate criticizing President Obama's offer to cut Social Security with liking David Duke. So
there is
a very demented wing out there.
All right. Let's just also turn our attention. Mitch McConnell this morning basically said, I reject Chuck Schumer's offer of calling witnesses. The folks like Joni Ernst and Susan Collins and Cory Gardner have already come out and they're saying, like, we need to get this over with quickly. And why would they need to get it over quickly? Well, of course, because it's doing so well for them. They're so excited about taking this vote in the Senate that they want to have it happen really quick so that we can forget about it. The other thing that people should note is we are still, and this is the case with every Republican in the country who is an office holder right now, a federal office holder, the deadline to primary them has not passed. What we are seeing right now from all of these people is the most pro-Trump posture they're going to take in this cycle. Because once the primary goes, you'll start to see Susan Collins try and distance herself. You will see Joni Ernst distance herself. You will see Cory Gardner distance himself. Right now is peak. Don't distance yourself from Trump unless you want to get primaried season. So this is as bold as they get, and you can still see them hedging. Let's just do this quick. I know President Trump wants a whole trial to exonerate himself, but they know what he wants is to put a tire around their neck so that as he sinks, they come with him. So I mention that only because I suspect that one of ABC's political analysts disagrees. She is a member of The View. And her attempt to to push this political analysis on the rest of the View members was met with a certain amount of disdain, which I have to admit, I enjoyed.
All right, we're back to the conversation. Go ahead.
What I wanted to say was, to your point about why Clinton perjured himself, is because he was willing to go under oath. Mm-hmm. Trump will not go under oath. He refuses to testify, as well as Mulvaney, Bolton, and Giuliani, all these people who are afraid to go under oath, particularly Donald. If he goes under, as I've said before, the lie machine will explode.
Joe Biden's not going under oath either, though, he said.
Joe Biden is not the crucial person here. He's not the one who's being investigated
right
now.
You're asked, if you're subpoenaed, you should say, I'm going to do what the law says I need to do. I'm going to show up and I'm going to testify.
But in his case, it's a separate issue. It's not germane to what is going on in the Senate right now.
Yeah, and I also think...
Pause it for one second. I mean, that is an important point to note. Who could you not subpoena in this trial if you could subpoena Joe Biden? Like, honestly, like, who could you... This is a trial about Donald Trump. Who could you not subpoena? If it makes sense to subpoena Joe Biden, who could you not subpoena? Could you subpoena everyone? Could I be subpoenaed?
Subpoena everybody.
Everybody's going to be subpoenaed. But Abby Huntsman, you know, one of those reasonable Republicans, brings up Joe Biden in this context. I mean, even Hunter Biden... who I think everyone would acknowledge got that job because his last name was Biden, also not germane to the question as to whether Donald Trump was doing this. What he did, these facts are not in dispute, as far as I can tell, rises to the level of impeachment. And if you want to establish Hunter Biden's guilt or innocence is irrelevant to the question as to, was Donald Trump on a one-man mission to make sure to root out corruption? Why didn't he involve anyone else in the government, all the government apparatus in this country that is designed to do it? Like when the DOD says we're okay with what's going on there in terms of like funding relative to corruption, when the State Department says that, when the Office of the OMB says that, when every single facet of your government says there's no issue, and you do not communicate to them that you even have an issue. There's no Hunter Biden or Joe Biden relevance in that trial. I'm happy to have the Senate open up another investigation. Investigate it. Great. Here is, let's continue with this.
Senate right now.
Yeah, and I also think, if we're going to talk about both sides and we're going to sort of make that comparison, I think we also have to compare the Senate vote before. You had so many senators that voted to not only impeach but also convict President Clinton for, yes, perjuring himself.
Yes.
Many of those same people are still in the Senate. I cannot believe that they would vote to impeach and convict a president, a sitting president, for perjuring himself, and they would not vote to convict a president
and remove
a president who clearly wanted to use a foreign government for his own personal benefit to impede our very democracy.
Right.
That is the height of hypocrisy. Republican-led
right.
Senate.
But my job
I don't understand that.
My job here is not to litigate the ethics of it. I'm an ABC political analyst along with being a View co-host. My job is to analyze the politics of it. And I'm telling you
Please stop talking right now. Because you know what?
No
What's
problem.
Happening? Thank
no
you.
Problem.
Thank you.
I won't talk the rest of the show. No
okay.
problem.
Okay. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. If you're going to behave like this.
I'm not behaving like
you
anything.
Are, you are. You are talking over.
Perspective.
Yes, we understand
no, I'm
that.
To talk,
but
and then
you
she...
are. But what you're doing.
No, I'm not.
Is your so we're not doing anything. How about this? Former FBI. We'll be right back.
Uh, We'll put up an address where you can send a muffin basket to Whoopi Goldberg. Now,
I don't think I've ever seen a 33-year-old woman be put in timeout like that.
Exactly. And should be. And you know what? Kudos to ABC for getting such an adept political analyst.
I'm a political analyst.
I have two roles. I am not just a host here on The View. I am actually a political analyst.
I'm a host, John McCain's daughter.
How much you want to bet like that was like, I'm only coming back on the show if I get the title political analyst so that I can show that I know more about politics than they do.
Should we watch that part again?
Yeah.
That's right.
My job here is not to litigate the ethics of it. I'm an ABC political analyst along with being a View co-host. My job is to analyze the politics of it. And I'm telling you
but
the
I'm
politics
not talking about
this,
you. I'm talking about
I'm telling you my
that
job
are
here.
Senators
let me
that
finish.
Are
I let
the,
you talk. Let
in
me
the
finish.
Senate.
Okay, wait a second. We get up. I want to get just her say I'm an ABC political analyst and we just got to do this. Then all right, I'm sorry folks. This is really I know juvenile.
What is she wearing?
I understand that. My job here is not to litigate the ethics of it. I'm an ABC political analyst along with being a View co-host. My job is to analyze.
It's like, you know, I was saying when we first saw this, there was this trend in filmmaking. I think it was really in like 2015, 2016, where you would explore the same tropes of like these horribly, basically racist 90s movies. Or, you know, problematic, whatever, like Driving Miss Daisy or something like that. Except at the end, Morgan Freeman would say, actually, screw you. That's what just happens.
Yes.
It's like, actually, you know what? You disgusting entitled trust fund baby who, as someone who's actually here on the merits of my talent, I'm going to have you be quiet for a second.
I'm not just a trust fund baby. I'm also an ABC political analyst.
Not just a trust fund baby. I'm also an ABC political analyst.
Folks, one of today's sponsors is News Voice, which is the first ever entirely open, crowdsourced, and democratized platform for news. And you can download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. Look, as you know, the vast majority of news is owned by the same five huge corporations. And it's important to pay attention to where you're getting your news from, what their slant is, etc. And the way to do that is to compare it with other stories about the same topic. And that's exactly what News Voice helps you to keep track of. It's a free crowdsourced website and mobile app that lets you create personal news feeds and maintain a clear picture where your news is coming from and what political slants may exist. It helps you aggregate news from corporate outlets, international outlets, local news, and independent media, giving you access to every side of the story. News Voice is fueled by its community of users. They contribute to the platform by fact-checking, submitting stories and sources that are missing. They upvote stories, and they write story summaries. You can also comment on stories, debate on politics, or debate politics, I should say, with other members. And through staying active in the community, you can level up. You can earn perks on the platform. The News Voice Play feature lets you listen whatever that personal news feed that you create for yourself. You can listen to it every day. It's basically your own personally tailored radio station for news. News Voice is a next generation news aggregator and social media platform that values transparency, good journalism, and productive political discussions. Get totally free access by going to newsvoice.com/majority. Put a link under this video if you're watching on YouTube. We've got it in the podcast description and more. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get extra content and you get the free show commercial free. All right, quick break. When we come back, professor from UCLA, Ramesh Srinivasan, on his book, Beyond the Valley, how innovators around the world are overcoming inequality and creating the tech of tomorrow. I'm going to skedaddle after the interview. Michael will take you into the fun half. Be right back after this. I could sleep. I could sleep. When I lived alone, is there a ghost in my house? I could sleep. I could sleep. I could sleep. I could sleep. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. Ramesh Srinivasan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Nice to join you. Thank you for having me. I love your show.
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you for being here and for writing the book. And let's just jump in with the sort of the most general question we can start with, which is what ostensibly is the promise of the Internet?
Yeah, well, the Internet was supposed to be, you know, an infrastructure, a global sort of technology that allowed all of us to bypass the hierarchies of political and economic power, right? It's a decentralized infrastructure, architecture, where peer-to-peer we could communicate with one another, meaning, you know, Sam, you could be one node of the Internet where you're based, I could be another node where I'm based, and we could create our own channels and share with one another. And in that sense, as just two random individuals, we could create, coordinate, organize across space, in theory, even across time. And in a sense, that is sort of an architecture that seems very democratic because it evades the, you know, the hierarchies of political economy of, you know, the Disneys and the Viacoms and the, you know, the big corporate, gatekeepers of our media that in many cases are a threat to democracy because they make corporate self-serving, if you will, manufacturing consent type decisions around what is made visible and what isn't. So the Internet is supposed to escape all of that. And the Internet actually started, the first point of the Internet is very near my office. I'm a professor at UCLA. And the first point of the Internet, it just turned 50 years old, actually, Sam, is just right next to my office. And, you know, it started at UCLA. The second point it was connected to at Stanford, and it blew up from there. And this is a taxpayer-funded, publicly funded network. The technology was funded by American taxpayers. I can't emphasize that enough because just like pharmaceuticals that originally came out of National Science Foundation, American taxpayer public funding, we now see the Internet turned into private, corporate, I would say potentially monopolistic hands.
Right. Socialize the cost, privatize the profits.
And give nothing back, give very little back.
Is there, and to a certain extent, your book is tracking almost like, you know, the path not taken, I guess, on some level, mm-hmm. in places that it has been taken on some level, yeah. You know, as examples. But was this inevitable? Like, I mean, as you look at this, and I know this is, you know, this sort of more, you know, not necessarily fully in your portfolio, but was it inevitable? Were there key yeah. junctures where a decision was made that could have gone the other way?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there absolutely within, you know, again, technology is never about technology itself, right? Technology is created by people, by organizations based on political and economic values and priorities, right? So, you know, the Internet, if you layer the Internet on top of, you know, kind of American globalized capitalism and neoliberalism, you can start to see what the Internet turned into, which is, it's still awesome. You know, like your show is, I'm able to access your great show by the Internet. I work with the Young Turks very closely. We're very much Internet based, etc. Right. You can see that. The issue, though, is if you layer it on top of the fact that in the United States and actually across the world, private corporations are elevated to such high status and such high treatment that by definition are self-serving. What ended up happening is as all the information exploded on the Internet, it became exponentialized. Private corporations became our so-called solutions to make sense of it all, right? We would search for information because there was so much information out there, but we trusted a private corporation to do that. We would hang out and interact with one another on Facebook, which is a private corporation. But the only reason we go onto YouTube, we go onto Google, we go onto Facebook is to see what one another are posting, right? but a private corporation lies in the middle that is dedicated to one thing and one thing only, its bottom line, its profitability, and its speculated valuation, because some tech companies like Uber are not actually very profitable, but they're worth over $100 billion, right? So the private corporate layer on top of this architecture of decentralization is part of how we got to this point. So that is what we need to kind of roll back a little bit and start to think about: what kind of internet do we want? Sure, you know, supportive of businesses is fine, but should it come at the cost of everything else? Because what we've allowed now is the private corporations to make decisions that are in their own self-benefit that maybe they don't even intend in and of themselves, but have turned out to have sociopathic outcomes, right? Like algorithmic, you know, inflammatory and hateful content becoming that which goes viral online, or, you know, setting up a mechanism for super shady and sketchy third parties like Cambridge Analytica or the Russian government to manipulate what we see on Facebook, or setting up these mechanisms by which, you know, inflammatory, hateful, racist, colonial type of content can become the basis for smear campaigns, you know, with Rodrigo Duterte and Jair Bolsonaro, and now in India with Narendra Modi. So these issues are massive at scale. And the problem is if we let private, self-centered, self-interested corporations to make the decisions about our public lives, which are increasingly interwoven with the internet, we're asking for trouble. And that's why we have to balance this. And that's what I'm arguing for in Beyond the Valley, in the new book.
I guess what I'm trying to get, and I want to go back over, you know, some of that, but you know, for instance, when the combustible engine was developed, let's say that it had been developed by the U.S. government, and there were certainly decisions that were made at that time, certainly, and by the U.S. government, of how we're going to use the combustible engine. Is it going to be primarily something that's going to create public transport, or is it going to be used for individual vehicles? And we're going to build highways and road systems that are like this. If we have trolleys that are going, you know, that are on tracks, we're going to dig up those tracks in the city and we're going to pave it over. Like, it seems to me like, did we have a similar moment? And I don't know that we even had that moment. I'm just using that. I'm making that up in terms of the combustible engine. But did we have a moment where there were certain decisions that we could have made that, in terms of a framework, that allowed for this overlay of corporate interest that began to dictate the shape and the form and the way that we access the internet, and the sort of, like, both, you know, Facebook and these other mediums are bridges to other people, but they're also, they're sort of like, they're tunnels, and there's tolls, and it eliminates the room for other bridges and tunnels that don't necessarily have tolls.
Yeah, it's a great question. So a couple different moments. I think a first major moment occurred when decisions were made very intelligently by, you know, companies to, you know, become our go-tos for the internet without charging us anything, right? So, you know, you can see sort of the Netflix model, which still collects data on you, but then you can see, more importantly, you know, the Google model, right? Which is, instead, treats us as the product, right?
Right.
We are the product being sold to one another. So that was something that started to come into being, Sam, about, you know, Google's about 20 years old, but this really took off, I would say, about 15 or so years ago. So that is one major, you know, flashpoint where there was an implicit acceptance by everybody that, you know, that a free internet is equivalent to a free search engine, even if we now find out it is disastrous for our freedom.
Right.
So that's one. But then another, here's a huge transition that occurred, honestly, is the mass consumption and the mass purchasing and release of smartphones. Huge, huge impact, right? Especially the iPhone. And why is that? Because now, as all of us are carrying these phones around in our pockets, we are not only trackable, but we are constantly, 24/7, 365, releasing and emitting data to these big data systems, to these server farms, to these cloud computing networks. And as we did that, it represented a qualitative shift where we gave up a great deal of our own personal sovereignty, but also communities that would be at risk, you know, to be biased against by these algorithmic systems became more and more at risk.
So
and I can talk about that.
Well, yeah, I want to talk about that. I just let me just put a flag down here and say that had we in that early era, and I was around and during the first .com bubble when people were still trying to figure it out on some level, had we in that era basically said, you can't collect data, you cannot collect geotagging data, you cannot have cookies. You can't do anything that isn't directly a function of providing better, like a very narrowly tailored definition of what better service is. So if I show back up on your website, you can keep me, you can have me have a login type of situation, but you can't follow me around the internet. And so therefore it makes the whole model where it's like, if you're not paying for it, then you're the product. It makes that just simply not available to these companies. And in that case, they're going to have to figure out another way of monetizing the internet. And so it's not going to be through tracking us.
Exactly. So it, you're onto it, Sam. I mean, it's partly that we gave up our data thinking that it was just for advertisements, but it's partly that we didn't understand that an advertisement is not the same as an advertisement. Now I'm being a little glib, but what do I mean by that? So, okay, Facebook has certain data on me, or Google has certain data on me, and they're going to sell me, quote unquote, better soap or better shoes or better cars or whatever. Americans, more or less, and actually a lot of consumers around the world, are more or less okay with that. We have an understanding that things are being gathered about us that influence so-called personalized advertising. But that is not actually what's happening here. What is happening is far more pernicious. Here's what's happening. Data is being retained about us at all points in our life. Where that data goes and how that data is being used is a big unknown to us. The fact that we can combine and aggregate data about us is also something that people don't know about, right? For example, Sam, I can buy your credit card records and monitor you on your smartphone and monitor you on, various applications like Facebook and so on. And I can aggregate that data. And I can have data, I don't know, if you're in your 40s or 50s or 30s, say if I have data about you from when you're 18 years old, and I can have that data and I can use that data. So what does that create in composite? It's not the same as selling someone, one soap versus another. It creates the possibility to structure and influence your life behaviorally, politically, economically, even personally and psychologically in ways that have great power and control over you. That is why this is such a big problem. And that is why there's so much more at risk. And it's not just about, we need to regulate Facebook. It's much more about the fundamental questions of people: who has power over our lives, and how do we want to have governance over our lives? And it's those issues that are at stake here. And this is why this industry, if you look at it as a whole, represents the most, the highest valuated companies outside of this new Saudi, company, oil company, which is the state company, the most valuable companies in the history of the world, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple, to some extent, Microsoft. Look at their valuation. And why are they so powerful? It's not because of selling their services, as we already talked about. It's because of what that data means, the valuation of that data, not just with advertising, but in all forms of life. Because we do know as human beings, when we are fed certain stimuli, right, like all of us, when you see something or hear something or it changes your mind. It influences us. We are social animals. So when we are put down these behavioral rabbit holes that suit corporate interests, but also support super sketchy interests like Russian government, who wants to radicalize us and turn our entire, society into something that's kind of very divided, then you can see the impact of that at play. I mean, for the record, I'm not even trying to overplay the Russian thing, because I don't actually I haven't read much evidence showing its actual material impact on our election. And I've talked to Noam Chomsky about that very issue.
Well,
for his book.
I want to talk about that. But I think like this point of what the implications are and just how sort of like how it's impacting us structurally. Now, it's almost like it's beyond individuals because, you know, and I just, you know, we talk about the phones. I just read that there is an outfit in Texas. Apparently, the Trump campaign is using them. Apparently, there was a Democrat and a Republican politician who was using them in the 2018 election, which tracks people on their phones. And I think people should know this. Virtually every app, except for the Majority Report app, as far as, you know, I can guarantee that one. But virtually every app that you get, there is a packet. I think they call it SDK or whatever it is.
Right.
It sends all this information about you, where you're going, where, you know, it has your maps and it tells and it collects this data. And then they sell it to hedge funders or to companies or whatever. It's just like a completely sort of overlaid side business. And what it does, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but they will structure our days. Not, you know, as individuals, they don't care about us. But as human beings going through basically what they perceive is just sort of a lifestyle that will maximize their profits, they will put the supermarkets in this location because they know a certain number of us go by there. That can be good in some instances, but in other instances, it can mean that any other values that we have as a society, what is good for the community, where should we have a park? Because maybe it's better to have a park there than it is to have a supermarket. All of these things are being structured on such a sort of almost a transcendent, on one level, a transcendent level, and another on such a subterranean level that it is influencing the trajectory of human development, much in the way that our economic systems does, but even more narrowly tailored to the benefit of very, very narrow group of people.
That's right. That's right. Because what you can do is, I mean, again, what you, the ability to have such rich data and be able to compute on that data to make behavioral decisions around how to steer people, how to influence their minds, how to influence not just what they purchase, but how they politically perceive themselves, politically perceive one another, even their qualifications. We are using algorithmic and AI systems based on data trails and digital footprints that are gathered about people to make decisions about people's worthiness, their credit worthiness, right? I mean, these are experiments that are underway in China, but they're not that different than what's occurring now. We can make predictions using digital footprints about whether, you know, what kind of insurance you're worth. How risky is it to invest in you and your life, Sam? You know, we can make those kinds of decisions. So what are we finding out? Those systems, again and again and again, are perpetuating, normalizing, and even worsening the inequalities of our country. They're criminalizing Black people. They're taking Black people who don't have felony records and predicting that they're going to have felony records or giving them harsher court sentences. That's in courtroom algorithmic systems. We're deploying AI systems for predictive policing that are treating Latino neighborhoods in East LA, like right near where I live, as gangs, even if there's no actual gang, quote unquote, gang behavior from any sort of, I would say, reasonable interpretation. So what is happening is a Minority Report type situation where, combined with the Hunger Games, where it's like those people who have always been treated worse in our unequal country, in our imperfect union, if you will, are even worsened through these systems. And the worst part of it all, and here's the key point, is because it's technology and data, everybody just thinks it's neutral. They're like, oh, this is better than a judge, or right, this is better than the police. The problem is what is occurring here is a tool that is taking, you know, police brutality and courtroom injustices and the prison, you know, school, you know, prison pipelines, you know, et cetera, and actually normalizing and making them worse. And so technologies right now are an amplifier for injustice and inequality. And we sure as heck need to get this right. And that is what this book is about. That's why I wrote Beyond the Valley.
And the distance from human beings doing this makes it less and less accountable as it progresses forward.
Great point. Because the developers of these systems and the companies that have created these systems tend to again, reinforce inequalities in our country and world. You know, most engineers are male. That's a wide, you know, widely known bias that women are under-equipped or unequipped to be scientists and engineers. We found out that AI systems are constantly selecting men over women for technology and science jobs, like automated systems. So the biases are reinforcing themselves. The fact that it's generally white, almost always male, sometimes Asian, and also the class-based, you know, we're talking about very wealthy people who don't necessarily, even if they're great people, don't really understand the experiences of others. And we're also talking about geographic biases, right? So if the world is socially engineered from Shanghai, Seattle, and Silicon Valley, and these technologies are just thrust upon billions of people. Remember, over one third of the world's population uses Facebook, and Facebook owns Instagram and WhatsApp is very widely used across the global South. These biases are going to be geographically pernicious. So this is a way of extracting and harvesting data. It's a new type, I would say, of digital colonialism. And it's really, we really have a huge opportunity to get this right, because I'm not even trying to get into this space of just yelling at people or calling people out for being, you know, and claiming that they're sociopathic or ascribing intentions to anyone. I'm an engineer by training, a lot of friends in the engineering space, and I know that a lot of us just don't know about these issues or don't know how to deal with these issues, which is why, again, I wrote Beyond the Valley, because my arguments in this book are, you know, what if predictive policing, if we even wanted it, was designed by Black Lives Matter? What if, you know, Sam Seder and the Majority Report got to be part of the algorithm design for Facebook's newsfeed that promotes journalistic content? Why are you all absent from the processes of design and the processes of auditing these systems? You all are just basically subjects of these systems. All of us are blind. And that is not appropriate. That's unjust. And that's not balanced.
And it is going to exponentially exacerbate inequalities and flaws in our society, because we have engineers making an algorithm based upon what exists on a data form, if you will, without any contextualization as to it didn't have to be this way. There can be an alternate reality that, you know, if you were to create, as I guess as an example, like an algorithm as to, you know, who we're going to serve, whose interests we're going to serve, and you were to do this in, let's say, 1859 in, you know, the southern states, you know, it would be geared, you would set up a system that would perpetuate slavery, and you could step back and say, like, well, look, this is completely neutral. I'm not for or against slavery. I'm just looking at the data as it exists now, and I'm using that as a tool to build about, you know, how we can make things more efficient and maximize them. That's an extreme example, but that's the dilemma that we have in relying on these types of this type of engineering.
You've captured it beautifully. I think you're completely on point with that. And that's why there are false comparisons being raised. So when I raise these issues, right, of, you know, algorithmic AI systems being used in courtrooms or police departments, or, you know, these things, by the way, Sam, are everywhere. These AI systems, we don't even know when we're interacting with AI systems, and we don't even know, there isn't disclosure when we're interacting with things like facial recognition systems, which across the board have turned out to be racist, by the way, and are being used by ICE to try to round up, you know, so-called undocumented immigrants who in many cases do have documents but are misidentified as being undocumented because the mugshot databases in our unequal country are full of black and brown people, right? So I get in kind of arguments or discussions with people around this, and they say, hey, well, it's a technology, you know, technologies are something we need to improve upon, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, I agree with you. Sure, we should improve upon the status quo. But you're asking the wrong question. You're not the comparison of whether a racist judge or a racist algorithm is better is an inappropriate way of framing the issue. The question should be, what kind of world or society we want to live in? Let's come together around that, a progressive agenda that actually the majority of Americans believe in. And let's design and build and influence and regulate technologies in that image. The question shouldn't be, oh, well, a racist algorithm is better than a racist judge. How, you know, that is a very, how do I say, a very sad way of describing what we can do.
But yeah. I mean, to me, a racist algorithm is far more problematic than a racist judge.
Sure.
Because a racist judge can die and be replaced by a different judge. A racist judge can see, can all of a sudden gain a different awareness. And a racist judge is subject to other human beings questioning them and not perceiving him or her, that racist judge, as being, value neutral. The problem with a racist algorithm is the lay people can't make that assessment, A. B, as the algorithm operates, all the data that it pumps out, all the solutions that it finds are then used again as the basis. And it's almost like you're tracing a figure. And every time you trace around that figure, every time that data that goes through that box, it gets even more exaggerated because it becomes the basis of, it was based on a flawed input. And then the flawed input puts a flawed output out, and so on and so on and so on. And
that's right. It's recursive. It's recursive, and it actually magnifies the problem because it's a feedback loop. That's exactly what you're describing.
Exactly. All right. Well, so we've talked about the problem and but your book is largely about, like, you know, here's the other thing that we could be doing.
Totally.
And it culminates in your data bill of rights, which I want to get to, but I want to just talk about a couple of things. I had not heard about the Red Hook Brooklyn Wi-Fi thing. I am aware of the New York City Mesh, NYC Mesh, which is a similar thing, I think. But let's start in Kenya, though, first. We'll go to Kenya, and then we'll go to Red Hook.
Sure.
Tell us, why did you go to Kenya? What is it in Kenya that's happening that's relevant to this conversation?
Yeah. So the continent with the youngest population in the world, fastest growing population in the world, and fastest spread of the internet in the world is the African continent. And it's kind of a weird thing to even call Africa a single entity, because it's the most biodiverse, linguistically diverse, culturally diverse part of the world. It's a mind blower. I've been all over the continent, and it's just incredible. On a systemic level, this is an important point I make in Beyond the Valley. You know, the internet doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes from fiber optic cables that are underneath the ocean surface. And the continent of Africa is actually very underconnected to the continent of South America. In other words, the fiber optic cables are very similar to the way that economic power functions in the world. Everything's connected through Europe and so on, right? So that's an important point. However, in the country of Kenya, very near Mombasa, which is the largest port in East Africa, massive port, there is a fiber optic cable landing point. It's a cable that also connects to eastern Tanzania in the Serengeti area. The reason I give this background is the ability to connect high-speed internet is not some sort of panacea in and of itself, as we've spoken about. But by the way, I do want to make the point that the connections that we get in America on mobile and internet, and this is something we're talking about in the Sanders campaign, are much, much worse than actually what is possible. They're like 20 times slower than what they have in South Korea. But nonetheless, back to Kenya. There is a landing point, and here's the reality. The combination of that accessibility combined with the culture of actual innovation. The reason I use the term innovator in the title of this new book, Beyond the Valley, that I wrote, is because I'm taking the term back. I'm asking what innovation actually is. And what you see in the country of Kenya is everyone is hustling. And that could be a term that people think of in a negative way, but I mean it in a positive way. People are doing more with less. They're trying to figure out ways to bring some income in, to create businesses, to create all sorts of civic opportunities. And there's a strong history there of businesses that are collectively or cooperatively owned. People have found solutions to overcome the constraints they face, from the electrical grid to the absence of banking systems, etc. They've built mobile money systems. And I'm not talking about cryptocurrencies, but people are literally trading credits. People are innovators. They're innovating through constraint. And so what is happening in Kenya? People are realizing here are the constraints we face, but here's what we can build out of it. So I give a few examples of this in the book. I'll say these really briefly. One is, you see this actually in other parts of the world as well, even in LA where I live, Los Angeles where I live. People are taking dead electronics, things that we throw away, things that are designed to die, because Apple devices are designed to die. It's called planned obsolescence. Mm. It's not that different than a Monsanto seed, which is designed to die. It's horrific to me. And what are they doing with it? Instead of just having this be e-waste that everyone gets cancer from and destroys the environment, people are taking apart these technologies and building new technologies out of them. This is what they call juakali, or which means hot sun. There are people who have tables and soldering guns under the sun, and they're just, it's an informal economy where they're just creating businesses out of this, creating, you know, everyone is just trying to repair phones, recycle phones, create new electronics. That's just true with phones. People are doing this with tires and desks and televisions and metal of all forms. It's so inspiring to see that whole new way of thinking of a secondary and tertiary economy that people do through their creativity. So that's one layer. But if you take this to another layer, you won't believe this. I have seen people, and I write about this in Beyond the Valley, literally taking discarded, dumpstered, they don't have dumpsters there, but basically, you know, like recycle, like dumpster diving for e-waste, and have built 3D printers out of these things, 60% out of e-waste. And they have built functioning 3D printers that have incubated a new industry for 3D printing on the continent and across East Africa. The 3D printers are a fraction of the cost of American and Chinese printers. And they, here's the killer part. They work way better. They work way better because they're designed by innovators who understand the environment within which they're designing for. The closure, there's the distance between the developer of the technology and the people and environments where the technology lives is closed. And that's the major problem we have with tech today. And in Kenya, you see alternatives. You see people using solar power to spread Wi-Fi. You see, you know, I'm sure you've seen this in different parts of the world, Sam. You just get on the street corner and there'll be a van going some direction. You're not really sure exactly where it's going. You just get in the van. You tell the person where you're going. One guy takes your money, another one is driving, and they tell you where to get off, and then maybe you take another van. This is a kind of innovation where people are hustling and they're figuring out ways to innovate. All of these things are collectively. That's all.
Ramesh, hold on. We're having a little bit of a problem here.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry. You broke up. Go ahead.
Okay, sure. So it allows me to raise questions in Beyond the Valley, like, what if Uber was at least partially, if not completely, owned by its drivers?
Right.
So basically in Kenya, you can see these alternative models for technological innovation that are sustainable, that are environmentally conscious, that are inclusive of everybody. And that, I think, is really important to understand, that the blueprint for technology is not defined by our own, you know, trauma at this point.
Well, so what, I mean, what's preventing, you know, I've watched this, you know, specifically, let's just talk about Uber in that respect. Like, yeah. And we can maybe sort of get into a couple of points about the data Bill of Rights. Yeah. What is, like, when Uber first came on the scene, I kept hearing, like, I would talk to the Uber drivers, and some of them were like, yeah, there's some guys in Florida, and they're trying to do, like, a co-op version of this. And you know, I've seen competitors come and go. Juno just closed shop in New York, which was a real shame, because they, to a certain extent, they were giving better deal to their drivers. But it occurs to me, like, well, look, the technology is there. Like, why can't, like, what is preventing, or what do we need for there to be a cooperative driver-owned version of Uber in this instance? Is it we need to constrict Uber, or is it that we need a plan to, like, where government offers, like, here's a $2 million loan. If you can show that you've developed a co-op of drivers, come, we'll give you $2 million. You'll have the operating costs for the first year or whatever it is, 6 months. And as cash comes in, you pay off the loan. I mean, what do we need to achieve that?
Yeah, definitely. Well, part of the reason why we've turned to Uber and become reliant on Uber and Lyft and so on is because they have so much, they're operating at such large scale that it allows them to price fix in a way to get us as consumers to be hooked onto their services. Obviously, all of these tech companies offer a lot of efficiency, and I need to make that point. That's part of the reason why we use them. So Uber is a great example of that, right? There is some evidence that Uber prices are artificially low because of investment to get us hooked onto Uber so that more data is provided to Uber, which then allows a company like Uber to be the top dog in, for example, the automated vehicle industry. So this is a model that seems good for consumers, but on like in reality, you know, at scale is actually very disastrous for workers, because you know the workers are in big trouble. For everybody, everybody in the society is in trouble as a result. No unionization, no living wage, no benefits, no insurance, unless drivers are in the car. They're all dispensable. These workers are dispensable. They're cogs in a machine that will ultimately be run by computational and automated systems. Now, to contrast that with what you're suggesting, it is absolutely critical we figure out ways to incentivize alternative models of ownership and equity in relation to enterprises of all kinds and businesses of all kinds. And increasingly, businesses are all going to have some big data and AI kind of social media type component to them. So yes, absolutely. I think what we need to do is figure out ways, and the state can help us with this, of incentivizing alternatives that people can turn to, so that as consumers, we can start shifting away from this Uber model toward using a model of Uber, which is like efficient and lots of people can use it and very, you know, kind of good for consumers, but without the costs to the workers, without the costs to the larger society, you know. And I think that is the key here. You know, we have proposed some legislation, or I would say policy proposal, as part of Senator Sanders' 2020 campaign that came out last week on what we call Internet for All. And within that, there is an incentivization financially to support community networks, municipal-run networks, right? Imagine your Verizons and AT&Ts, but instead they're run by local community organizations, or, you know, like you were saying, NYC Mesh. But an NYC Mesh that has a lot of power because it has the funding and support behind it. We're even trying to incentivize Native American populations to support their own infrastructures, like internet and mobile telephony infrastructures. So I think there are ways to balance this out and move away from this point where we are, where we're like blindly forced onto and dependent on these tech platforms that turn out to be very bad and unhealthy for our society and actually our world. And part of it is by shifting through policy, but also by giving others a chance, by giving small businesses a chance, by giving nonprofits a chance, by giving collectives a chance, because it's actually small businesses that hire far more people, Sam, than any other form of enterprise in our country. They are the key to job growth.
So,
and the right kind of job growth.
I mean, largely what you're talking about is a almost like a two-step, maybe not necessarily sequential, maybe yeah, simultaneous, both an antitrust perspective on these things to curb their size, to undercut their ability. I mean, if we were just tomorrow to say, can't sell data, can't share data, can't collect data, can't sell data, except for maybe a very narrow band of data, and essentially made a lot of these businesses just simply not lucrative, not worth pursuing, a bunch would go away, a bunch would innovate and redirect where they're going. But then also on the other side, incentivize, provide government assistance to people who are innovating other ways of making a business out of this stuff that is less, that has less of an ability to redirect where society is going, and more like getting cues from society as to where it should go.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, what actually Uber did is designed its way around the minimum wage law by calling its employees independent contractors, right? And so you know, it's an all-hands-on-deck situation. We have to support a more competitive environment where we can't just be, we can't just be disrupted in a very negative way by the dominance and hidden and unaccountable actions of tech companies that are completely self-serving and Wall Street backed. We have to, it's all hands on deck. We have a competitive environment, regulatory environment, and more importantly, just introducing alternative imaginaries and understandings into what technology is and who it serves. I have no fundamental issue with machine learning or AI. I was an AI and machine learning developer back in the day. The issue is all about who governs it and who has power over it. Of course, we can apply great big data and various types of algorithms to understand climate data, for example. But the boundaries of that question need to be, the way we put it is deterministic, meaning they have to be very specific, right? We're looking for this with these parameters. We're controlling this very, very importantly. Most importantly of all, we need to ensure that human beings and the right kinds of human beings that also are very invested in the public interest are the ones in charge of these technologies. That is essential. You know, they audit it, they design it, they regulate it, they make sure that the technologies only have this amount of use, only access this amount of data. You know, we check this thing very carefully because what we're doing is, you know, these companies claim to be engineering for society, but what they're actually doing, Sam, is social engineering.
Right. Right. All right. Well, so lastly, let me ask you this. I know you're a surrogate for Bernie Sanders. Where does, to what extent, I mean, you've talked about, sort of antitrust, but you've also talked about a government taking a bigger role in the development of technologies and ways of interacting with the internet that are in, after the regulatory reform, you know, sort of narrower corridors in some ways, but that's going to open up areas that we don't know. I mean, this is... back when I was in filmmaking, you know, Dogma 95, you had limitations, that. Technologically that, you self-imposed, but it changed the nature of your storytelling. And, yeah. And some ways that's what we're looking for here. Where does Bernie Sanders fit in on that, in that?
Yeah. I mean, it's very, very clear to all of us. I think really across the country that, that Senator Sanders stands alone as the person who has the track record, unwavering message that stands with the working class and the middle class. And actually, I want to add small businesses. He is the person who forever, I'm sure you've watched some of his, interviews from the 80s. It's uncanny. We know what he stands for, right? And we know that his interests are not in government takeover of everything, but his interests are in government making sure that the excesses and the greed and the sociopathic outcomes of big corporate America don't end up harming a situation that has gotten so bad, right? He says, as this is a Bernie line, but three people with the equivalent wealth to over 50% of the U.S. population. Now, the internet and new technology was a catalyst of that occurring, and it's going to get way worse, as we've spoken about, right? If you notice, some of the wealthiest people in the world have all made their money in some facet or other involving the internet. And if we see these forces of displacing workers through the gig economy and automation starting to come into being, we're going to see workers that are even more precarious, our country even more divided, even more full of anxiety. So we start with what Sanders stands for, which is working people, middle class people. And then we think about technology and the digital economy and the economy of all kinds accordingly. So what Senator Sanders has put out is pretty incredible. As part of the Green New Deal, there is a lot of investment, as I mentioned earlier, into infrastructures that are governed for and by people. Now, infrastructure is kind of a nerdy and boring term, but what I mean is, mobile networks, internet networks, those things are accruing so much money. So why can't the wealth that's created by that and the jobs and the employment and the digital literacy skills and the educational skills all be transferred back to communities and organizations, the right kinds of stakeholders who are not just invested in their own pocketbooks, but everybody else? So that's one example of what Sanders has proposed that I think blows everyone else out of the water. Another big example of this is his corporate accountability plan and his workplace democracy plans. These are really important because what he's actually asking for in these policies, I encourage everybody to take a look at these, is providing employees and workers greater equity, investment, even board seats in our enterprises. You know, Bernie is not anti-business. He's not even anti-corporations per se. He wants these things to be fairer and equitable and supportive of working people, of the 99%. So one way to do that is to take this great model that has created a lot of great innovations, which is the business, even the for-profit business, and make sure that it's not extractive and it's not zero-sum, that the people who are part of those organizations have who are the employees of those organizations have great power over what the decisions those organizations make. So this is these are the kinds of themes of digital inclusion of you know internet for all that are really part of this campaign and his and he pays particular attention and this is actually I would say even different than 2016 at vulnerable communities in our country. There's a lot of there's a lot of stuff out there in these policies and proposals to support Native American people, to support women in poverty, to deal with prison issues, to deal with youth issues, but also to deal with vulnerable people of color and minority communities. So all of these policies are have an eye of compassion toward giving everybody an equal opportunity. I mean, that's the America that he believes in and I believe in. And I think that's why this campaign is standing alone. And my goal in the campaign is to just be a voice to support the great policies that we're putting out and to also add my two cents on policies that might relate to my areas of expertise. You know, I have a piece coming out, Sam, I think in the next week in The Guardian called Why We Need a Digital Bill of Rights. And within that, I'll describe some aspects of what Senator Sanders, Bernie has proposed. But it's more generally a blueprint to make sure that we get everything balanced. Beyond the Valley, my new book is about restoring balance to this digital world. It's not just a book that criticizes and trashes and vilifies the status quo. It paves the way toward a world where everybody is uplifted through technology rather than more division, more inequality, more injustice through the digital world.
Ramesh Srinivasan, the book is Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. We'll put a link at majority.fm. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Nice. And, that was a great interview. You're a great interviewer. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks.
Nice. Nice. And big cosign. That is a great book. I discovered Ramesh's work through Anna Kasparian. And he actually, I think he's also a Sanders surrogate.
He's
a very, very smart guy. we're going to go right to the fun half, folks. Not a huge amount of time because everything ran pretty long. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how all this happens. Less than a cup of coffee a day. Subscribe on YouTube if you haven't already. Go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Tonight, we're live 7 o'clock on TMBS. Go to the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Go to patreon.com/TMBS to check out our new illicit history of AMLO's first year in office and using the drug war to potentially foment a coup against him. Of course, got our upcoming Bell House show February 7th, but we just wanted to let you really quickly know that there's a new website out here. Just went up. Want to thank David Alexander, our super talented intern, but professional photographer for TMBS, who helped make the, put the website together. And TMBS.fm, we've got a catalog where you can buy hoodies and merch. Nice tees, nice hoodies. Of course, there's a Become a Member. And you can see descriptions of our latest shows. And then if you go up on the menu, you can keep track of live shows, our catalog, YouTube, Patreon, and also the upcoming book. So where you can see all the blurbs that we have so far. So anyways, guys, check it out, tmbs.fm. Jamie.
Oh, you know, that reminds me. We, too, have merch for sale at the Antifada. It's a little more ad hoc. It's also a little bit cheaper. We have some T-shirts left. So if you want to DM our producer, Andy, at Space Prol on Twitter, he can set you up with some. Anyway, this week on the Antifada, where unrest is best, we have an interview with Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing, about the history of the modern police state, why liberal reforms have been insufficient or downright counterproductive, and what would need to happen to actually get at the root of these problems, as well as the ongoing protests against the NYPD in New York City that Andy and I have been a part of. We also have a new bonus up for our patrons. It is Andy's series on Latin America. This month, he's got Camilo Gomez, a Peruvian writer, discussing how the Lavajato spilled onto Peru, making anti-corruption a focus of the upcoming legislative elections. They talk a bit about the Peruvian left, and then they go into some idiosyncratic tendencies like the Trotskyist eco-socialism of ex-Posadist Hugo Blanco and the UFO leftism of Alpha E Omega. And that is out now, patreon.com/theantifada. Also, tomorrow we have an episode coming out on the Russian revolutionary Victor Serge.
Matt.
Coming up on Literary Hangover is the second most published book in English of all time, Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, written in the 1670s. Basically, it's sort of the Lord of the Rings of that sort of 200-year period where the guy goes on a journey. A very similar sort of thing, and meets obstacles and sort of things like that. But I think it's about Christianity.
It does a tremendous job.
It's about Christianity, but really it could be about anybody on a sort of ideological journey. And I think that's how I took some meaning out of it. So look forward to that, folks.
Cool. Everybody go to patreon.com.
Patreon.com/literary hangover.
Do you still put them on YouTube too?
They're still on YouTube, yeah. Up to about 3,000 subs on there.
So. Go over there, click sub, click subscribe. Subscribe to everybody's show on iTunes if you haven't already. That also helps. All right, folks, we're going to see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerky's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerky.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of back. Hell out of back. Hell out of back. Hell out of back.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck, fuck, fuck. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Or blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. 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 Pussy.
Welcome to.